and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the Town of Griffith succession plans. Vice President Mike Pence made a visit to his home state this week. Sharon Jackson reports on tuition assistance at Ivy Tech's Michigan City campus. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Valparaiso University professor Julie Peller. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A House-approved proposal giving the town of Griffith an extra year to join either North or St. John Townships could advance next week through the Senate. On Thursday, the Senate Local Government Committee voted 8-0 to forward House Bill 1177 to the full chamber with a recommendation that it become law. The Times reports the plan gives Griffith 2 years until November 2020 to transfer townships instead of the one-year requirement in current law. Griffith citizens last year voted to secede from Calumet Township due in part to the township's highest in the state poor relief property tax rate. But so far, both North and St. John Townships have shown little interest in absorbing Griffith.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Lake County has sued Indiana in a long-running dispute about who is responsible for defending probation officers accused of wrongdoing in their official capacity. Filed in late March in Porter Superior Court, the lawsuit names the state of Indiana, the Office of the Attorney General, and the Lake County Probation Department as defendants. The lawsuit asks a trial court to determine whether probation officers ultimately work for the county or the state. The question isn't merely academics. Potentially millions of Lake County taxpayer dollars are at stake. That's because, under current practice, the county is on the hook for the expense of defending probation officers and paying out civil damages to their accusers. The Times reports Angela Jones, a Munster-based attorney handling the lawsuit on behalf of the County Council and Board of Commissioners, argues it should be the state of Indiana that is liable for damages against probation officers. The Indiana Attorney General's office did not respond to a request for comment by press time. The county's lawsuit was motivated by a raft of pending litigation involving the probation department. In one case, a Gary woman sued Lake County in 2015, alleging physical and mental injuries at the hands of her probation officer. In such cases, Lake County is responsible for any compensatory or punitive damages awarded to the plaintiffs. The county aims to change that argument by showing that the probation officers fall under the Indiana court system for the purposes of official liability. If successful, the case could set a precedent for other counties in the state. According to Jones, Lake County opted to file its action in Porter County Court in anticipation of a change of venue from Lake County Superior Court. The county's lawsuit also names Lake County Superior Court judges Salvador Vasquez, Clarence Murray, Diane Boswell, and Samuel Kappas due to their affiliation with the probation office.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A steelworker has died in a fatal train accident at the ArcelorMittal Indiana Harbor Steel Mill in East Chicago. ArcelorMittal spokeswoman Mary Beth Holford tells the Times the worker died Tuesday morning when the engine the worker was operating struck a rail car on an adjacent track in a raw materials yard. Holford says ArcelorMittal, the United Steelworkers Unions, and outside agencies are investigating what happened. The death is the first at ArcelorMittal's Indiana Harbor Steel Mill since two occurred there in 2017, one in a crane accident and the other in a buggy accident.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Lake County Commissioners held off on buying 22 new police cars for the Sheriff's Department, wanting to know how the outfitting of the cruisers is being paid for. The Post-Tribune reports, on Wednesday, the Board of Commissioners delayed purchasing new police cars until Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. can explain how the county can cover the cost of getting the cruisers ready for the road. The anticipated total cost for the 22 cars is $545,326, and that's without upfitting. Sheriff Martinez recommended the county buy 10 Dodge Charger Police Patrol sedans for a total cost of $257,470 and 12 Charger Detective and Administrative sedans for $287,204 from Thomas Dodge in Highland. Thomas Dodge received a 1% local business preference before the final cost was calculated. The anticipated cost to upfit the cruisers is in the range of $200,000 to $225,000. Radios for the cars would be another addition to the costs. The commissioners did, however, agree to buy a jail transport van for $28,174, a figure that includes titling and document fees.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Two men charged in connection with a rash of copper wire thefts in Hammond as well as neighboring Illinois communities have pled guilty in their case. The Post-Tribune reports 23-year-old Daquan Ray of Burnham, Illinois, and 30-year-old Joshan Escavera of Hammond each agreed to plead guilty to one federal count of interstate transportation of stolen property. Ray entered his plea Monday and Escavera pled guilty Tuesday. Ray's sentencing is August 6th and Escavera's is August 8th. Police have said the men were spotted in September coming out of the Cook County Forest Preserve in Calumet City, Illinois. They were arrested with a large amount of copper wire. Thefts also were reported from decorative light poles in Hammond, light poles at East Chicago Athletic Fields, and other communities.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A Wisconsin-based sub shop will open its first Indiana location this summer. Cousin Sub will open at 10533 Broadway Street in Crown Point in July. The Northwest Indiana Business Magazine reports a company representative said Cousin Subs seeks to open at least 5 locations in the state. It is also expanding into the Chicago area, recently opening its first location in January. The company operates nearly 100 locations around Wisconsin and Illinois. Expansion into the Chicago area as well as Indiana is part of the company's plan to grow in the Midwest.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A pay equity study shows Indiana ranking among the lowest states in the nation when it comes to paying men and women equal wages for the same work. The American Association of University Women's 2017 analysis compared median yearly earnings by gender in the 50 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, and compared protection and solutions offered to workers who face discrimination. The Evansville Courier and Press reports that the analysis shows Indiana scored below the national average in wage parity. Indiana men are paid around 37% more than their female peers. AAUW says the national median is around 20%. Indiana ranked 49th, with adjacent Illinois and Kentucky ranking 38th and 33rd, respectively.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Vice President Mike Pence made a visit to his home state, Indiana, Thursday afternoon to chat with farmers affected by the Trump administration's policies. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, trade was a key topic.
Farmers from across Indiana met with Vice President Mike Pence, sharing their concerns about how the trade disputes have been difficult for their farms. Danville farmer David Hardin, a third-generation hog producer, says he came to advocate getting markets back open.
One of the things that was very important for me to hear from him today was that he understands the dire financial straits that we are in.
For his part, Pence attempted to point the finger at Congress to ratify the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement.
President Trump is fighting to expand exports, expand trade, but it's time for Congress to act and move the USMCA.
When asked about President Donald Trump's next meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping about their ongoing trade war, Pence responded, "We'll see." For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An evangelical group in Indiana says the need for renewable energy is, quote, a pro-life issue. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, members delivered a petition with 21,000 signatures to Governor Holcomb Wednesday, urging lawmakers to expand wind and solar energy.
Members of the Evangelical Environmental Network see it as their job to protect God's earth. They say Indiana's position as one of the top 10 coal-producing states puts Hoosiers' health at risk, including that of unborn children. The group is calling for the state to enact policies that will help Indiana achieve 100% renewable energy by 2030. Reverend Kyle Myard-Scop is the director of outreach for the EEN.
It gives them freedom to pursue solutions at the speed and scale that we need to address environmental pollution and the climate crisis.
The group says clean energy also employs more than four times as many Hoosiers as coal and natural gas. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
You can own an entire Indiana town. The small Brown County community of Story is up for sale. No one really lives there, but it's home to a popular bed and breakfast, restaurant, and event venue. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, those beloved destinations aren't going away.
Story, Indiana, dates back to 1851, when a doctor founded the Brown County town. But most people today know it as a quiet and charming tourist destination, featuring a bed and breakfast, restaurant, and event spaces. Now the town and its historic buildings are for sale. Rick Hofstetter is one of the partners at the Story Inn. He says the goal is to preserve the town for future generations, so they won't sell to just anyone.
This town is zoned general business. People can do some stuff with it that I wouldn't necessarily approve. So as long as I have breath in my body, we're going to have restrictive covenants to make sure that this place doesn't become a Yogi Bear campground.
Hofstetter says the current businesses will remain in operation after the sale. They'll just lease the buildings from the town's new owner. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A northern Indiana school is sending leftover food home with some students to help feed them on the weekends. Woodland Elementary in Elkhart has teamed up with South Bend-based food rescue nonprofit Cultivate to send 8 individual frozen meals home with 20 students every Friday until the end of the school year. Cultivate's Jim Conklin tells local WSB-TV it takes well-prepared food, combines it with other food, and makes individual frozen meals out of it. Natalie Bickle of Elkhart Community School says there wasn't anything to do with leftover food, so Cultivate comes to the school 3 times a week and rescues the food for students who might otherwise go hungry. The food rescue program is a pilot program for now.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana University officials say 6 students have now been diagnosed with mumps amid an outbreak of the virus on the Bloomington campus. IU spokesman Chuck Carney says 3 more mumps cases were confirmed late last week. The first 2 cases were confirmed in February, and a campus outbreak of the illness was declared last month after a 3rd case was confirmed. Carney says 5 of the 6 students diagnosed with the viral infection live off campus. He goes on to say the university and health officials are offering free vaccinations to anyone who came in close contact with the illness, which most often occurs in children and teens at schools and dormitories. IU previously had 5 mumps cases in early 2016.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana House rejected an attempt Monday to raise the cap on rental fees cities can charge to landlords. Current law says municipalities can't charge landlords for an inspection fee of more than $5 per unit. Those charges are often passed on to renters. Bloomington and West Lafayette, college towns with significant rental inspection programs, were exempt from that cap until a recent state Supreme Court decision eliminated those exemptions. In response, West Lafayette Democratic Representative Chris Campbell wanted to raise the cap for all cities to $150 per unit. She says the inspection programs help keep people safe.
A lot of those inspections have led to cases where there were not fire alarms in the homes or too many occupants of the homes.
But Republican Representative Todd Houston says jumping from a $5 cap to $150 is a dramatic increase.
One, I cannot support, and I'd appreciate your vote against this amendment.
Campbell's amendment failed 21-73.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Senate Republicans gave their final approval Tuesday to legislation they say creates hate crime protections in state law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Governor Eric Holcomb says he'll sign it, though amid constitutionality concerns, there's no guarantee it will get Indiana off the list of five states without a hate crimes statute.
The legislation says judges can enact harsher penalties if crime was motivated by bias against any trait or affiliation. Republican Senator Mike Bohacek, the bill's sponsor, says that language encompasses everyone. The bill also references a list of victim characteristics, which Bohacek calls examples.
We're trying to encourage our judiciary to do the right thing when they see that bias.
But the list excludes sex, age, and gender identity, which has drawn the ire of many advocates. Democratic Senator Jean Brough calls the measure sexist, ageist, and transphobic.
So I can't call it a hate crimes bill, and I think you're deluding yourselves if you call it a hate crimes bill.
The bill passed the Senate 34-14, with four Republicans joining Democrats in opposition. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A state Senate panel has amended a school safety bill after teachers were shot with plastic pellets during an active shooter training at an elementary school in northern Indiana. The amendment would bar the firing of projectiles at teachers, school employees, or students during any drill or training. The Indiana State Teachers Association requested the amendment following the training exercise in January at Meadow Lawn Elementary School in Monticello. During the training exercise, instructors fired on the teachers, saying it demonstrated what would happen if they weren't proactive in responding to an active shooter. Educators were left with welts, bruises, and abrasions. Lawmakers say the exercise went too far. The Indianapolis Star reports the Senate Education Committee amended the bill Wednesday, and it now proceeds to the Senate Appropriations Committee.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill allowing pharmacists to refuse to dispense abortion-inducing drugs is one step away from becoming law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Senate lawmakers sent the measure to the governor amid heated debate.
Current law lets doctors and hospital employees refuse to participate in abortion procedures for religious, ethical, or moral reasons. This year's legislation would extend that to pharmacists, nurses, and physician assistants. Republican Senator Liz Brown, the measure's author, says healthcare providers shouldn't have to violate their beliefs.
And as the abortion industry has evolved, so have their conscious protections.
But Democratic Senator Mark Stoops says the bill lets healthcare providers impose their religious views on their patients.
You are now allowing licensed and certified professionals to deny care, which is part of the responsibility of their profession.
The Senate approved the bill along party lines. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Trump administration wants to nix part of an energy efficiency standard on specialty light bulbs. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the Natural Resources Defense Council says the move could cost Indiana households $93 in savings a year.
In 2012, the Obama administration added specialty bulbs, like in chandeliers, sconces, and floodlights, to the energy efficiency standard for lights. The change doesn't go into effect until next year, and the Trump administration doesn't want it to at all. Andrew Dulaski of the Appliance Standards Awareness Project calls the Obama version of the standard one of the best climate and energy policies people have never heard of.
And there's really no good reason to go backwards. The technology is as good as what you see in the LED light bulbs.
The National Electrical Manufacturers Association has opposed the Obama version of the standard because it wouldn't allow them to sell some specialty bulbs. The public has until May 3rd to comment on the proposal. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
For the third time, a large group of pigeons has been found abandoned in the same rest area dumpster off Interstate 65. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg reports.
Rest area attendant Edwin Hensley discovered the birds late Sunday night, as he had twice before during his evening trash run. This time, however, the pigeons had been dumped directly into one dumpster, while the boxes in which they were transported were discarded in another. Of the 51 pigeons they found, 5 were already dead, possibly drowned in the several inches of sitting water in the receptacle.
At least give them a citation. Somebody has to be accountable, or it's just going to keep happening.
Wildlife rehabilitator Kim Hoover, who's worked to find homes for the first 2 batches of pigeons, called the White County Sheriff's Department for help reaching animal control. But when she didn't hear back by Monday morning, she returned to the rest area to retrieve the birds herself. Hoover says her purview is wild birds, not domestic ones, and that animal control should be in charge of rescuing and housing the abandoned pigeons instead of the wildlife centers, who have now repeatedly volunteered to take them on.
I have never heard of anything like this in my entire career.
That's White County Sheriff's Department Deputy Chief David Roth. He says White County Animal Control has handled farming animals like horses and cows, but never pigeons. Roth also contends that since the pigeons were found at a state-run rest area along I-65, they're ultimately the responsibility of the Indiana State Police. Still, he says the department plans to start investigating. In total, nearly 200 pigeons have been abandoned at the rest stop since December. For WBAA News, I'm Emily Seiberg. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A lack of childcare has become an issue in many Indiana cities, not just because parents have to take days off to watch their kids, but also because that loss of worker productivity hurts municipalities hoping to grow. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports.
Inside Wabash College English professor Agata Stashak Brewer's office, markers and crayons are scattered on the floor, along with paper covered in a child's artwork.
Just today, when I was waiting for you to arrive to record the interview, I had both kids with me at the office.
Her 20-month-old daughter was sick and unable to go to childcare for today. But for her 9-year-old son, it's spring break, and Stashak Brewer was unable to find a place that would watch him for the week.
So he spent the entire week with me at the office, going with me from meeting to meeting, going to the classroom when I was teaching. And so that certainly wasn't optimal for him or for me.
Stashak Brewer had to cancel student meetings and dedicate work time to watching her children. A recent report from the Indiana Business Review says it's a common problem. The study examines the ratio of children to childcare providers throughout Indiana and finds Montgomery County is one of many struggling to meet demand. Crawfordsville faces a tough challenge, with national unemployment at 3.8% and Indiana's even lower. It's competing with other communities to attract workers. But for workers who choose the city, it has to have amenities they need, such as available daycare. Perry County officials and businesses collaborated by bringing groups together to form a community child care center. With a population of about 16,000, Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton says large corporations only locate smaller branches in Crawfordsville, meaning it's less likely those operations will offer their own child care to employees. So he's assembled what he calls a child care initiatives team to look at possible ways to address the shortage. He's trying to bring businesses together, but has looked at other solutions, including encouraging unlicensed child care providers to consider licensure.
Many of them are not licensed. Maybe they're apprehensive about that process. We want to, you know, just make sure that they understand it's not a scary process and that we are here to help guide them and bring them along if they so choose.
Okay, who's ready for crackers?
Cookies!
Egoses. Trinity Carr serves peanut butter and crackers with milk to the children at her in-home business, Precious Lambs Daycare.
Are you done with your bottle?
Before becoming a licensed provider, Carr watched just a handful of children at a time, which is legal in Indiana, so long as no more than 5 unrelated kids are being cared for at once. Eventually, she decided to grow, which meant seeking a license, a move she believes made people more comfortable coming to her.
I felt that with being licensed, parents would be more lenient towards a licensed in-home because they know that with license comes with rules and regulations that I would have to follow.
Having a license has also given her the ability to get food reimbursement and take vouchers from parents. But like many daycares, a lot of her business has come through word of mouth. And that's led to a common problem. creation of a waiting list that can go months between available spots. Carr says Crawfordsville must have childcare, so she supports others opening up their homes as either licensed or unlicensed providers. But state officials say getting a license can take 6 months to a year from the time of application. Agatesh Deshakbrewer is still on the wait list for a licensed center to get her daughter into, but has been able to find a temporary spot at an unlicensed facility. And while she likes the teachers, she has concerns.
There are some structural problems and overcrowding, but that is our only option. So beggars can't be choosers.
She says she loves her job and has no plans to leave Crawfordsville. But if she does, she says childcare availability will be her number one priority. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Some students attending Ivy Tech's Michigan City Paycheck Campus are going to be getting some assistance paying tuition with the help of the Meet the Need pilot project. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Cindy Hall, Executive Director of Resource Development, about the project.
So tell me what the Meet the Need project is.
The Meet the Need project is an initiative that was spearheaded pretty much by First Source Bank. Is they had come to talk to us about what could they do to help our students get to the finish line, meaning graduation. And essentially what happens is students take loans out for tuition. They sometimes run out of their Pell government money, and they just don't have enough money to get to the finish line or, you know, the books to take their classes and things like that.
And how does that happen, and why does that happen?
There's probably a lot of different reasons. I mean, students have, students at Ivy Tech, for the most part, are students that have families. A lot of times they have two jobs. They're coming to school part-time. They've got to pay for their son or daughter's education, and they sometimes will run out of money for themselves. And so they'll apply for financial aid. And, you know, they whatever happens in their personal lives, sometimes it's just not enough. So what we like to think is that the Meet the Need initiative is giving them a hand up as opposed to a hand out. And like I said, is a lot of times they just run out of money or loan money, and they don't have the, you know, what it takes to buy the textbook or something. So that's where we came up with the Meet the Need. And then they just need to go to financial aid. They evaluate their records and take care of it to, again, help them get through the class and hopefully get to graduation.
Do they have to pay the money back that they get from the Meet the Need project?
Oh, no. This would be scholarship money.
How much money do they get?
Every case is individual. It's not a standard template. Like, for instance, if a student's tuition bill is $1,500 and they only need like $200 to pay it off and they just don't have it, then it would be like a $200 scholarship.
How do you identify the kids and the students, I should say, that are at risk?
Our financial aid department does that.
And how much money is in the Meet the Need pool?
Right now, there's actually, because of the result of the generosity of First Source Bank, there's $15,000.
And I do want to ask you real quick, because according to the news release that I had came across, it said that the RSVP was by tonight for your fundraiser on April 5th. So that's a little late would you still accept people to come to the fundraiser at the door?
Well, because it's all a plated meal. If people were to call me at 476-4710, we could still take reservations probably till Tuesday. But we're doing, everything's all pre-assigned seats. And like I said, it's a plated meal. So I actually have to give a number to the Aberdeen this afternoon.
Are you guys sold out?
Almost. We're getting there. So that's just what happens is everybody waits till the last minute and we just jockey accordingly.
How did you get the word out about this fundraiser?
We actually still do a snail mail invitation, and then we do email blast, and we do text on social media. We try to accommodate all the various ages and technology that there's out there so that different ages of people will hopefully see it.
What works best?
Well, I know some people say they can delete you on the swipe on their cell phone, and others say they really like the actually invitation that they can put on their desk and remember to actually send in a check. Others, you know, like the email version, and then they can just get their tickets online.
Is there anything else that maybe I have not asked you about that you want to mention about the program or about the, you know, the situation of students and paying for tuition?
Well, I think at the end of the day, helping Ivy Tech students helps the outer community. I mean, if we can keep our students enrolled so that they can continue to pursue their degree and they graduate, then they can get better jobs and then they can spend money at restaurants and buy things, and it helps support the greater good of the overall economy and sparks economic development.
Cindy, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, by all means.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here is Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Valparaiso University chemistry professor Julie Peller.
On Saturday on the Valparaiso University campus, there's going to be an interesting discussion, the topic of water pollution. Well, that's nothing new here in Northwest Indiana, is it? We seem to deal with these problems all the time, and historically, too. And the faculty members from Valparaiso University are going to get together with other environmentally focused groups and like-minded individuals as well to host this discussion coming up on the VU campus. And we have with us one of the organizers of the event, chemistry professor Julie Peller. Julie, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your major study and research as well as in teaching is dealing with such things as environmental chemistry and the like. And water quality is one of the projects I know that you're working on the side with some financial help here in Northwest Indiana in particular, in North Lake County and probably North Porter County too, because I know there are problems there too, but mainly here in Lake County. But how did this particular idea of a thirst for clean water, which is the title for this discussion coming up, how did it come about?
The thing that I've realized in doing this work over the years, as a scientist, we can discover information, and then the question becomes, what do we do with that if we find there are problems in water quality? And I've slowly but surely begun interacting with people who are on the policy end, and that's part of how this all came about. We realized that we need each other when it comes to water quality issues and making sure that we have good water, surface water quality. And that really ignited this idea in between Valparaiso University, the University of Chicago, its environmental, Abrams, it's called Abrams Environmental Law Clinic, mm-hmm. and just local environmentalists, as I've mentioned, Walt Breidiger, who leads the Valparaiso Chain of Lakes, actually brought us together in discussing our mutual interest in protecting water, and this kind of came about because of that.
That seemed to be the major problem we have, is that we have these great sources of drinking water, one huge one, of course, at the very north end, which is, we're talking about Lake Michigan, of course, but these other sources, we have all these other sources coming in, rivers and streams and all, and they all could possibly be polluted if it's, things are not done right and taken care of.
That's correct. And one thing that we have to remember, too, is any of the areas that are part of the Great Lakes watershed, including North Valparaiso, anything that ends up in those surface waters eventually leads to the to Lake Michigan, or, you know, in the Great Lakes watershed. Mm-hmm. And so what we do around this area is what we put in our surface water here can affect the surface water in the Great Lakes, which so many of us rely on for drinking water.
Is it a question that you and your colleagues and others have had, not only on Valparaiso University campus but elsewhere, about not only dealing with the current problems but trying to find ways to prevent them in the future?
And I think that sometimes that our laws and our regulations are not keeping up with what we're finding in the science, and I think that's part of what we want to get across in the symposium that we're holding on Saturday. Mm-hmm. There are what we call in the science word emerging contaminants that sometimes don't get enough attention. And so this is one venue for us to talk a little bit more about some of these things, some of these pollutants that most people have never heard about.
Do we know of any of them in particular? They're just, at least right now, in such small amounts that they aren't causing problems. But as the industrial community continues to grow, that we're going to see more of these contaminants out there?
Yeah, and you know, one class of contaminants that we call persistent contaminants are those that end up in our water, in our environment, that nature really has never figured out how to handle.
Uh-huh.
And one of these that I've been focused on for the last few years, and as you've mentioned, we've gotten some funding through the EPA and through the National Science Foundation, is looking at the microplastic pollution, and namely we've been focused on what are called microfibers. So our clothing that most of us wear that, that's been around for quite a while, what we often call polyester and nylon, these sorts of things. In the chemistry world, we have a different view of them as the chemical components that get out into our environment. And just like any other plastics, these microplastics, these microfibers, they're persistent. They do not degrade. They don't go anywhere. So as we continue putting these out into our environment, they're accumulating, and accumulating to the extent that we can see the macroplastics, this massive pollution problem that we have, it's actually happening on a smaller scale that we can't see. And so this is an example of this persistent pollution, this pollution that accumulates. It doesn't go away because nature doesn't have those mechanisms in place.
Now, it's sort of like it's on the other end of the scale where we talk on the other end about the problems of putting plastic containers into landfills because they don't biodegrade. They don't degrade at all,
that's
actually.
Right.
They sit there and just
that's
stay
right.
there, yeah.
And so we're finding that we have these fibers that come from mostly from our clothing, from blankets, these microfibers that we've all thought have been just such a nice part of our world, and having different types of fabrics and soft blankets and this sort of thing, they shed a whole lot of these microscopic fibers, and we're finding them in almost every water sample that we take from our local creeks. There have been recent studies on tap water and bottled water, in which case as much as 90% of these samples have these fibers present. So, again, these are pollution, this type of pollution that we don't hear enough about, and this symposium will give us a forum to discuss these topics and make people more aware of them.
And I know you're talking in particular here about not only the chemistry problems, the pollution problems in general, and how it can probably set up policies to deal with them too, but probably should look at ways to bring attorneys into all this and coming up with, and law students in particular, and getting them involved in finding ways to help protect ourselves.
Exactly. So that's kind of the meeting of our minds that came together. So if you look at our schedule, we have Robert Weinstock giving a presentation. We have Aaron Korn from the Hoosier Environmental Council. He's also an attorney in talking about some of that side of water protection, as well as some of the interns at the Environmental Law Clinic that will be speaking about these sorts of things. So I think that kind of makes it a little bit unique of a symposium, is that we're bringing in the science and kind of the policy angles, and sort of hopefully giving everybody this nice comprehensive picture of how we address these issues.
We're talking with Valparaiso University chemistry professor Julie Peller about a symposium is coming up on Saturday. It's entitled A Thirst for Clean Water, and they're going to be kind of a discussion and a meeting of the mind, so to speak, on the problems of water pollution in Northwest Indiana. And Professor Peller, tell us about the person who's coming in and doing a special presentation, Mark Edwards.
I was fortunate to meet him at a chemistry conference about a year and a half ago, where he presented about his experiences and taking his science and really making an impact in different communities, and he continues to do that. And reached out to him and just said, you know, this is something we would love to have you talk about in this area. Water's important to us, given we're part of the Great Lakes watershed, and he was gracious enough to accept our invitation. So I'm really pleased that we have him as our keynote speaker.
And I guess he's been involved here, as you say, here in the Midwest with problems, and speaking of water problems, like the ones that are still, I guess, persisting in Flint, Michigan.
His role, I believe, was to help the people understand what the problem was, did lots of testing at his lab, and his students figure out what the problem was there. And then, like I said, the scientists do their job and then pass it on to those that you know, are involved in dealing with the infrastructure and the people in the city. And so I'm not sure. I think that that's kind of, like I said, that's the role of the science. And then we have to interact and work with other people. And so he's been working on other in other communities and doing other things.
Well, it sounds like that Mark is going to have a very attentive crowd. There'll be a number of people that not only from the community, but from the legal and the scientific professions that will want to listen to what he has to say and what he's learned over the years from his work in particular.
Right.
Professor Keller, tell us again where A Thirst for Clean Water is going to be held on Saturday, and if anybody's interested, where they can be able to reserve a seat.
Right, we're taking advantage of the law school and using the auditorium there on campus, and it begins at about 8:35. We're delighted that President Mark Heckler will initiate the symposium, and it will go until early afternoon. And so there's a registration online. If people are interested, they need to just go on to the registration, online registration that they can get to through the VU website. And we're looking forward to, you know, having a nice crowd there.
Well, it sounds like a great discussion to bring people in on a weekend to talk about problems like water pollution, the ones that now that the weather is getting nicer, should be paying more attention to these days, to be sure.
That's right.
And Professor Peller, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Julie Peller is a professor of chemistry, and one of her research areas is in environmental chemistry, and she's from Valparaiso University, where this coming Saturday, beginning again at 8:30 in the morning until 1:15 in the afternoon in the School of Law auditorium on campus, is going to be a symposium entitled A Thirst for Clean Water.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by Ben Sound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.